authenticity is that is freedom of self-expression, of just what's coming out of my mouth, I can trust is true and for me, and is what I mean to say. And if people don't agree with it, that's fine, and I don't expect them to, but I'm saying what's right for me, and I will deal with the consequences of people who disagree with that.
You are listening to the Underdog Way podcast with me, Ruben Pillai, where I interview amazing guests who face adversity, overcome challenges, and found their purpose. We share stories to inspire change. Remember, your change will begin when you turn inspiration into action. This episode is brought to you in partnership with the Stop Holding Back Foundation, a charity really close to my heart that is focused on the personal development of people who stutter. A big shout out to everyone part of the SHB family. I love you all and thank you for the support. Every corner twice as bright, there'll be my treasures forever. When I can't hold you tight, I'll see the Stockholm lights. The Stockholm lights, the Stockholm lights. Our guest on this episode is curator, presenter, producer, and author Lew Batchelor, whose mission is to help people find and express the ideas and passion which make a difference in the world. Lew has achieved a number of incredible things, from presenting on Sky, representing Great Britain in wakeboarding, completing 100 sports in 100 days, TEDx curator, and hosting her own interview series, The Big Idea Show. Lew swears by her policy of trial and error. Adopt a beginner's mentality and don't be afraid to look stupid. This has led her to accomplish so much, and now she's here to share her experiences. This is a great interview, and I've learned a valuable amount about fearlessness, authenticity, and self-expression. Now let's get straight into the interview.
Actually, well, my talk was in Jodhpur, so Jodhpur, TEDx, okay. J-I-E-T, but yeah. I host, creator okay. of TEDx Folkestone.
Got it.
So there's a lot of pictures of me in front of the sign, so a lot of people think that I've spoken at Folkestone, but I just create that one.
It's confusing, but thank you.
It is. Great. It is.
I've actually been there before in the past.
Oh, no way.
In school, as part of the cadet force, and okay. used to go there in the midterm breaks, and we trained alongside the soldiers there and did the light version of their camps.
Wow, that sounds full on, but it sounds
pretty intensive, but it was good. Yeah, it was good. Just wanted to teach you about the main themes of the talk, then go into the spirit of pushing yourself,
definitely
embarking on challenges involving the sports.
And there was a number of reasons really, but I think the root of it was I believe there's a sport out there for everyone. It's just sometimes they're not necessarily the traditional sports that we do at school. They're not necessarily hockey, cricket, netball, things like that. And I guess I've been lucky in that I like grew up doing lots of sports. But always enjoyed it, but never excelled massively in any one particular. And then I went to university and I randomly came across the sport of wakeboarding and I absolutely loved it. And I picked it up really quickly and I ended up going on to compete like for GB.
Oh, but, brilliant.
But the bizarre thing was like that came about because of kind of chance, and I could have so easily have never tried that and then never found this passion. And so I think my aim really was for people who maybe didn't like sport, traditional sports at school, or hate the gym, but they go every January, they sign up to the gym,
yep.
and they never end up going because they hate it. And I like the gym, so I've got nothing against the gym, but if you don't like it, then I kind of think, go and find something you do like. And that was kind of the idea behind it, was find something bizarre like Quidditch or underwater hockey or fencing, all these like bizarre sports and to try and show people. And also the whole, you know, the overarching theme of explore and experiment. That was the idea. If you don't know which one you like, go and try loads of them. And it's okay that you won't be good at all of them. You will be actively bad at some of them. And that's okay, because you'll go, okay, I wasn't very good at that, I didn't enjoy that, well, so with that one. And then you try one and you're like, oh my God, this is it. This is my sport. And suddenly you have all this new motivation. Like, people think I'm really sporty, but actually I am very bad at motivating myself to do sports. But if I find something I like, I am like so focused on it. And I feel like I don't have to, in inverted commas, motivate myself, because it's just an inbuilt passion. And that's what the 100 Sports was about, was trying to help people find that inbuilt passion to do sport. But equally, that idea could apply to anything, not just sport. But that was the example, obviously, in that particular challenge.
That's incredible, because in the clip you have, I saw backflips, I saw fencing, Tai Chi.
Yep.
At some point. Diving, boxing, and I think the strangest thing I saw was a bicycle and a paddle and a ball.
Oh, the kayak polo.
That was on dry land.
Oh, bike polo.
Bike polo.
Yeah, there's lots of different. Who knew
that was like so Quidditch
many different
to
types
me.
Of polo.
Yeah.
Oh, and there was Quidditch as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So Quidditch is an actual sport that they actually play.
I did not know that. But I think I'll try that
out
now.
Yeah, it's great. And a great sport, because it's full on. It's like, you know, they were absolutely covered in mud, but
I've seen the films.
But what was really nice was, this is a full on, full contact, you know, sport, but it was nice that those people who were playing it might not have had the confidence to go and join a rugby club, for example, because when you play rugby, you probably played since you were a kid. So everyone's really good. So it's very hard to start as a complete beginner if you decide you want to start playing in your 20s, say. Whereas Quidditch, not many people play it. So everyone's at the same kind of entry level. Yeah. So everyone can enjoy it together. So that's what I loved about that one.
My background, Thai boxing and grappling, that kind of stuff. My first class, I took that back in 2010. Mm-hmm. And I went because I had two friends who were trying out the class. And they asked me if I was free. And then I said, yeah, sure. And they gave me the postcode.
Perfect.
And the distance from the club to home, 12-minute walk.
Yeah, perfect.
I went along and I loved it. And I stayed there till 2014. Nice. And then I competed as well. The experiences that you get. I started that sport when I was 21 years old.
Awesome.
And it formed a big part of life as well, the
social
training
side,
and all the benefits you get. After the challenge of the sports you did you carry on any of the new ones that you tried?
There was a few that I really wanted to do, but unfortunately, logistically, it was challenging. So one that I really liked was, ice hockey.
Yeah.
Like, because I played hockey, like field hockey, and I've done a little bit of ice skating. So I picked that up, but because of where I live, it was an hour's drive to get there. And then we had to train, because it was the only time they could get the ice rink, the women's team trained at 11:30 at night.
No way.
On a Friday.
Really?
On a Friday. So it would mean we train from like 11:30 till like 1 in the morning. And then by the time you get home, it's like 2 a.m. in the morning on a Friday, Saturday night. And I was like, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
So kind of, to be honest, and I like the rock climbing. So it's more, I think I took up more hobbies as opposed to, there wasn't one at the moment in time. But I'm still, sometimes it's, you know, sometimes when you buy a book and you buy it and then you don't get around to reading it, and then a year, 2 years later, you pick it up and it's suddenly the perfect thing. I think it will probably be like that. I'll dip in and out or maybe try something completely new. And so bits and bobs, but actually doing a bit more gym stuff, to be honest. But that's just a lot of the time to do with other work situations and timing. And you know what? It's like, at the moment, like, my work is my passion. and not so much on the sport, but then other times it will flip and it will be all about doing a new challenge or a new sports activity or something.
So, very, very cool. Yeah. I think a big part of it is the transport and the traveling.
Yeah, the logistics does make a difference, yeah, doesn't it?
With the sports you've tried and all the challenges, you seem fearless. Did that come from my siblings or parents or just the person that you look up to maybe?
That's a very good question. From a sports point of view, my whole family is quite sporty. They're not athletes in the sense that they don't compete, but I was lucky in my upbringing in that we were encouraged to try different things. And where I got that confidence to try things early on, I don't care enough about what other people think. Good. And therefore, yeah, I just kind of do it. And I when I was wakeboarding a lot of the women and the other girls would say, oh yeah, but oh, because you fall off, you like, it's very obvious if you fall off to like everybody watching. And I get that it can be quite embarrassing. But I remember thinking and saying to a lot of people, you're worried about everyone looking at you and thinking you're stupid. They're all too busy worrying that you're going to think they're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
and that was a big thing. So I definitely do get scared about doing things, but I think the difference is, like I said, about
fear,
sport.
Kind of. It's good fear.
I think it's
the useful kind of fear.
Yeah, I think it's more that I'm more inspired by the potential of something that I almost, and because I get so excited by it, I do it before I have a chance to think, is this a good idea or not? I think, yeah, I leap before I look.
I do that quite a lot as well.
Yeah. I think it's that, I don't do sport unless I'm really motivated by it. And I think in my whole life, I guess I'm not very good at doing things I don't want to do. I think people can find it quite frustrating if they're like, you should do this, and I just don't get around to it. So I only do the things I want to do, and therefore I'm always excited by them. And that kind of trumps, and you go, yeah, I'm a bit scared, but I'm also more excited than I am scared. Therefore, like, do it anyway. And act before you have time to think about whether you're...
Take action, right?
Yeah.
Take action before you're ready.
Before you think about whether it's a good idea. Yeah, totally.
That's cool. It's great, because you mentioned a point there about... the expression you have, we are stuck sometimes, and our thoughts and beliefs we have stops us from change and improving ourselves.
Mm.
And you try things out again and again, that gives you a confidence to take risks.
Definitely.
And that's the main thing, I think, right?
Yeah, it's definitely. And it's learning that it's making, doing enough different things that you can't be good at everything. But if you try different things, and you will inevitably fail at some of them, and you then learn, oh, I failed, but my life didn't end. Like, it's not the end of the world. My parents didn't disown me or anything like that.
Yeah.
And therefore you can be open to, well, I'm going to try this and I might fail. And I guess there's a balance in the, you know, how I said, I only do things that I really want to do, but at the same time, I'll also do things without worrying too much if it's what I want to do for the rest of my life. I'll just do it because I enjoy it now, knowing that if I don't, I can quit. Whereas I think a lot of us will try and plan, right, this is what I'm going to do with my life. And that's that big goal over there. And I've got to focus on that goal rather than going, you know what, it's okay to change your mind. And almost the quicker, but if you've spent months and months planning something and trying to get over the fear of doing something, when you eventually then do it, you kind of think, well, I have to stick at this now because I've spent so much time in the preparation. Whereas the quicker you jump on it and do something, the easier, the less you lose and the less wasted time.
Yeah.
Like, what's it called? They call it like sunk cost, don't they? The less sunk cost you have in the time worrying about it because you did it. And then you realize, actually, I don't want to do this. Quick, move on to the next one. You've wasted a few days versus a few months.
I haven't heard that term before, but I would.
What, sunk costs?
Sunk cost, yes.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And in projects, and he does the same thing. He does big, kind of crazy projects, and you get emotionally invested in them, don't you? And sometimes you
procrastinate a lot, and just kind of think, but then the days and weeks go, and the months eventually.
But even more so, you're like, well, I can't not do it now because I've spent all this time in it. So yeah, it's getting over that, getting through that quicker.
That was a good point you made about we're meant to have a purpose and a goal, and it's the one goal we have. For me personally, I think of the goals and the purpose like it's changed over the years, and it served me at that time.
Definitely.
And as the goals and purpose I had in high 20s are now are different now. I feel 32 this year, and my goals now are different.
Definitely. The goal is to work out what your goal is. Or like if you say, you know, in your life, the goal is to work out what your goal is. And it's
It'll keep changing, I think.
Yeah,
definitely. That's the problem, isn't it? And
yeah. And I think some of that comes down to if you have I think a lot of the time people want to go to the gym or want to get fit, as a good example of a typical goal that most people can understand, is I think what we want to lose weight or bulk up or whatever our goal is for going to the gym. But I think what we actually want a lot of the time, more than the physical goal or the aesthetic goal, is almost the trust and or the respect in ourselves or the self-discipline to know when I set myself a goal, I'm going to achieve it. And I think with the gym is like a prime example of that, isn't it? Of as much people want that feeling of, yes, I did it, whether they and the kind of whether you lose weight or look better or that kind of stuff is almost like a byproduct, but we don't often think about it like that, do we? And I think maybe you saying about the being courageous and going out and doing all these things, I think part of that comes because as a kid I was very focused and I was good at achieve. If I set myself a goal, I'd always achieve it. And so now I have this relationship with myself where I can set myself a goal. And if I quit that goal, it's because I've chosen to quit it, that it's not the right goal, but it's not, but I don't beat myself up that, I'm bad, I'm not disciplined, I don't have the focus or the vision or the discipline to achieve it. I've just realized, partway down the route, this isn't the road I want to go down, so I'm going to change direction. Whereas I think if you have that relationship, if you're someone who's not kind of set themselves and achieved a goal in life, you kind of almost have to achieve it to prove to yourself that you can achieve it. So that makes sense, the differentiation between the two. Mm-hmm. But if we can learn that young, we can learn, right, it's not me, it's that the goal's not right. And I think that's a big thing, isn't it? It's like we stick at it because we feel we have to, because otherwise people will think we're
failure or
exactly. But if it's the right goal, then it's a lot easier to achieve and it'll be a lot more fun, and you won't have to beat yourself up so much to get to the end.
In the past at school, there was a period where I played the keyboard, the guitar and the recorder, and my grandma would always call me a jack of all and the master of none. But then now I think it's the best thing, but you have a basic skill hitting a few things and a basic awareness around your core skills and core sports. I think it helps you to get the best out of life.
Yeah, definitely. And also it's that kind of, I get you with it in terms of the like jack of all, and but equally that's the trying lots, and if something's, when one's right, it will stick. Mm-hmm. And you will kind of, and but equally I think sometimes we think, for example, with a musical instrument or with a sport, we can think of, okay, well, you know, someone might say a jack of all, and I've always felt like this, like, I do so many different things. People will think I'm scatty and I do all this and like
be flaky and inconsistent.
Yeah, exactly. And that I'm a jack of all of them rather than being one. But now over time, I've started to see the pattern that yes, the projects are completely different and they're left and right and all over the place, but what's consistent is the values within them. And I would say I'm now an expert. I'm an expert at throwing myself in and trying different sports, for example, in terms of I am not scared to try any sport, whether I look stupid. So that becomes my niche, but the sport itself, like I don't want to be the world's greatest rower, for example, but I would love to be the world's greatest multi-sports person, for example, as an example. And that difference, and I think it's very especially kind of parents and at school, it's we have these categories of like which subject are you best at, whereas actually where you can make a real difference in the world is when you go, well, I'm pretty good at like for me it was like, okay, I like art, technology and maths. Like maths and technology do not go together. But then when I found, and sport as well, that in that whole mix. And then when I realized you could do like sports engineering and like all that kind of stuff, suddenly it was like, there's very few people who do that unique mix of things. So mm-hmm. I think that's where the trying different stuff, because you'll find a crossover and then you'll find your unique niche, rather than if you were to do, pick one sport, for example, to be the best at that one sport, or to be the best in like artist is very hard, but be the best kind of artist in sport, that's
your niche now, isn't it?
Exactly, right? So
yeah,
that's where we get the crossovers, and that's where we do, how many new discoveries have there been in examples, but a pure discipline or skill, but where there's big revolutions in design, for example, is when someone sees something in one sector and combines it with something in another sector, and that's when it's different. But you never kind of get anything new from doing the same thing you always did.
Exactly. I have seen a few of the clips you've done, and the highlights of the podcast you have.
Big Idea Show?
Big Idea Show, yeah. And I think of the way you speak to the guests and express mm-hmm. yourself. And I just wanted to ask if you had any training in the past. Practice and trial and error again?
I've never had any training as a presenter or anything like that. It came from my upbringing, as it were, in the, like, as a kid, I wasn't very good at expressing myself or my ideas. Yeah, I went to speech therapy for, I think I couldn't say my S's, and I still kind of can't always get my R's. Yeah, I just felt I wasn't very good at articulating myself, expressing myself. So I was quite quiet as a kid. And my mum,
I can't believe that, by the way.
And it's come over time, mm-hmm. but the reason it's developed, and like my mum was like, it's very chatty, it's very lively and bubbly and stuff like that, and as a result I think I got good at listening, whereas when I was young I was struggled to express my ideas, and it's something I've learned over time. Mm-hmm. And it kind of came, the Big Idea Show came, I was doing a bit of coaching for people, kind of small businesses, because it was almost like the thing that I wanted when I started my business was, I knew I could feel in my gut and like in my heart what I wanted to say in my marketing. I didn't know how to articulate it. I'm like, I do all these things and I couldn't get them into a nice short concise sentence to go on my website, for example. Mm-hmm. So I knew that struggle, and I went, well, if I'm struggling with that, there's probably other people who are struggling with that. So that's basically what I offered them, is what I wanted for myself, which was someone to just listen and let them go. You know, when you just have a brain dump where you're like, well, I'm kind of thinking this, but I'm not sure, but it's that. And often we pre-edit ourselves because we don't want someone to think we're stupid if we suggest this ridiculous idea that is never going to work. Or, you know, you might say, oh, I want to do this in my business. And then you say it, the words come out of your mouth, and you're like, oh no, I don't mean it like that, but it sounded wrong, right? And I was always worried about saying an idea and people not getting it. And you know, when they look at you funny, like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? Like, I don't get it, right? And I hated that feeling. So I wouldn't say anything because I didn't want people to not get my ideas. And then I basically got to a point where I got so annoyed with not sharing my ideas, but going away and doing them anyway. Like, I do them myself. And you know, when you work really hard on an idea and you deliver it and you finish it and it goes out in the world, but no one cares because you've not engaged anyone with your idea. So you've gone down a route,
mm-hmm.
and you might not have actually be serving like a product or a service that anyone wants because you've not asked them. And I got annoyed with doing all this work and not getting any results. So I thought, well, I'm going to tell them my idea up front, and if they don't get it, I'm not going to do it. That was kind of the thinking. And that started with TEDx. And yes, when I first shared it, it came out like gobbledygook. And I was probably looked like a mad woman, like, oh, we can do this. And I was getting overexcited with ideas. And I learned that basically only by, like the trial and error, like with the sports, when it comes to speaking and understanding your idea, you've just got to, it's like sharing it and getting it out. And as the words come out of your mouth, you hear them. And when you hear them, you go, ah, that wasn't what I meant. Okay, next time I'm going to say this. And it was I go for that trial and error, experimenting in my speaking. And now when I talk about TEDx Folkestone, for example, I'm much more articulate on it, not just because I've got better at speaking, but because I understand my own idea. And the problem as a kid, why I wasn't good at speaking, was because the idea hadn't fully formed in my head. And you have to get it out of your head and out into the real world through your mouth to realize, to kind of see, okay, is it, what is it? What am I holding here? And then you can better describe it. So, I mean, I know I've gone off tangent on terms.
No,
of
you haven't. No. Don't worry.
So that's in terms of expressing my ideas. It's like trial and error of expressing, of understanding my own idea. And through that process of doing it for my, working out how to do it myself, I learned that a lot of the time, all I wanted was someone to just listen to me and kind of go, do you mean this? Or are you thinking that? So that's how I interview, is how I would want to be listened to. And I just listen, and I try not to have pre-prepared questions, because, and I just get completely present. And I tell you, the trick is to not, if someone says something that you find interesting, or you go, or they say something and you're like, oh, I want to ask them this next, don't hold on to that question. Because if you hold that question in your head, you're trying to remember the question and you're not listening to the next thing they say. Mm-hmm. And then they might say, talk for another 5 minutes. And then you ask the original question that you thought 5 minutes ago, and it's now completely irrelevant. And therefore the flow of conversation breaks down. My approach that I go for is just being super present, really listening. And when you really listen, people open up because they get that you get them. And it's just, it's like, I don't know what it is. It's like the energy between you or whatever. They feel heard and listened to. And when someone feels that, they'll always keep speaking and do more. So it's like listening and allowing them to fill the space a lot of the time.
Perfect.
But they feel safe in that space. So yeah, sorry, a very long-winded answer.
No, it's fine. It's fine. There are some great gems in there as well.
Nice. I tend to use the process of speaking to work out what I'm thinking, which I didn't used to do. And it was just getting out, stop self-editing was the thing, basically.
It's a great skill, though. I think personally, I find with these thoughts and ideas, if I speak it out loud, then it sounds a bit more real than in your head. The podcast, I'm a part of the process at the start involved, e-speaking, to my friends about it and engage them about the concept and the name, etc. The feedback I got at the start was a mix of, oh, like, it's great. People said, oh, like, the name isn't that good. Change this and change that. And I took all the feedback in and incorporated it. Had that process helped, that straight away I could engage the people around me, and that gave me accountability. And that's a big thing that you speak about personally in about the ventures that you do. If you have a plan and idea, they speak to them about it. And if they say, oh, but is this the best time, or you have this and it's been done already. And if they speak a lot about the doubts and the pitfalls, dampen the mood a bit. What's your advice around that?
That's an interesting one. I think it's important, isn't it, to identify the different types of people. Like, for example, there's certain people I know I could go to and share an idea and they'd get really excited about it, but in a way that sometimes can be just as detrimental potentially, because they're just going, yeah, go for it. And especially if they're not giving any counter, not criticism, but they're not helping you further the idea, because they're just saying, yeah, sounds good, go for it. Whereas sometimes actually the people who are giving you the negative side can, it doesn't, I don't know, if people say you shouldn't do it, I don't agree with people saying you should not do it. But actually hearing someone's reasons why not, and why they think it's a bad idea, can be just as useful for feedback. Because, for example, say it's a family member, like say it's a parent, for example, and they say, oh, I don't think that would work for these reasons. What's in that situation probably interesting to go is, okay, where are they coming from? Like, if, for example, you came up with a new technology, for example, that's really cutting edge, that's online, that's about social media, for example, I'm being very stereotypical here, but an older person is probably not as engaged with that, so would go, well, that won't work, because why would anyone spend that much time online? But that kind of can tell you something, like, okay, maybe they're not my audience, like, I shouldn't be. It sounds obvious if you're building a social media, but, you know, as an example, okay, that's what that person thinks. Then maybe sharing it with a different type of person, and whether they come back with something positive or negative is almost looking at reading between the lines of what you can gain positive based on, even if they say something negative. And I mean, the other way potentially to look at it as well is, if someone's saying something negative and you are, yeah, but, and you're defending it and you keep defending it, then you know you really want to do this idea.
That's a great sign, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas if someone says something negative and you very quickly go, oh, okay, maybe it's not a good idea. I guess there's the question of, if you can't stand up for your idea after one person being negative, do you really believe in it? And I think it depends. I think it's your first time, you know, it's the first time you shared an idea ever. I know that obviously wouldn't happen, but if it was the first time ever, you'd go, well, that's a kind of a lack of confidence maybe in sharing your idea and taking someone's feedback too much to heart. But in the grand scheme of things, in a kind of reasonable situation. So I'd say the advice would be share with a number of different people and really get where they are. Like, they are coming from this environment. And I think particularly if, for example, you were to say, right, I want to go do this for my life, and it's a bit unusual, a bit random, and not a traditional 9-to-5 type thing. You know, our parents were brought up in a time where you had one job and you stayed in that one job forever. So they're obviously going to have concern, and also because they're your parents and they're coming from a different environment. So it would be, take that into account and don't hold it against them, because I think it can be quite easy to go, oh, well,
you didn't get it, too old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But go, no, it's perfectly kind of viable that they would think that. And no, what was the quote someone said, Tommy? It was like, no feedback is bad feedback, because it's their opinion and they are not wrong in their opinion. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you have to take it on board, and it doesn't mean that you have to adopt it and that they're right for your course of action. It just means that's their opinion. And it can be hard, but there'll always be pro supporters. And to be honest, I try and take my ideas to someone that I know will be brutally honest with me and will tell me all the negative things, because then I am going into something fully aware of what I let myself in for. And if they convince me out of it, I'm like, okay, yeah, maybe you're right. I guess there's that conviction. I have quite a lot of conviction of knowing why I'm doing something. Therefore, and I'll tell you on a separate note, that's kind of more on a, you know, taking feedback and having conviction about what you're doing. But from another point of view, another way to think about it is, the first time you share this idea, whatever it is, assume it's going to be, you'll get a negative feedback because you will share it badly. Like, you know when you make pancakes?
Yeah.
And they always say that the first pancake is always rubbish.
Well, my first two, but...
yeah, first two. Well, there we go. Yeah. Even more of an example. Mm-hmm. Assume the first or second time you talk about this idea to someone, you won't explain it right. You will explain and it will come out your mouth and it will sound silly and you'll be like, I didn't explain it to you right. Great, but you, in that process, the next time you share it to someone, it will be better. So there's that to take into account. It's kind of being responsible for how you articulated something, and know that you can always find other ways of saying the same thing. And this is what a lot of the TED speakers will do, is like, okay, they've got this idea, but they can talk about it in this way, or they can talk about it from this side or this point of view, and know that you'll be, it's almost like being responsible that you'll get a certain reaction if you share it in X way, and another reaction if you share it in Y way. And all you can do is be responsible for your choice of language, or even setting things up. Like, sometimes I think, you know, if I share an idea with, for example, my brother, and he's tired and he's had a long day, of course he's going to be more pessimistic. If I do it at a good time and maybe ask him about his ideas first and listen to him, be supportive.
And listening the skills and everything in there.
Exactly. But he's then been hurt, listened to.
Yeah.
And then he's more likely to listen openly to me. I guess a final tip would just be, on, in terms of sharing ideas as well, is being clear with people what you want, how you want their response. So what would be an example? So, you know, when you give someone a piece of writing, sometimes people will come back and be doing spell checking and stuff like that, and you haven't even finalized what you want to say. You're kind of just getting sense. So you could say to someone, like, I want you to tell me do you get this? Like, does this as a piece of writing generally make sense? Ignore the spelling and the grammar, but do you get the point? And they may say yes or no. Or you may ask them to read it and say, I'd like you to go through this from a spelling and grammar point of view. It's the same when you speak in terms of sharing an idea, is you can tell them, like, I want you to, your personal opinion on whether you agree with this or not. Or you could say, I want your opinion on whether you think it's the right idea for me. because it's a common thing, isn't it? People will say, I wouldn't buy it, that product, but I think there might be a market for it. And again, it's understanding that person's not your audience. Therefore, should you take their opinion? But they can still have an opinion on whether other people, like, would any of your friends buy this, even if you wouldn't? That sort of question. So just prepping your audience for what sort of response you're looking for.
That's a great answer. That's very, very cool. I just wanted to ask you a bit more about the TED process and the experiences of the event and planning and entire process, really.
Would you rather hear about it from a speaker's point of view or from an organizer's point of view?
Let's go from the organizer's point of view.
Okay, so the process of organizing it, and tell me if you want me to go kind of more, because I can be very specific, or I can talk like kind of, you know, the wider general values point of view. But so I'll try and get a balance. Is to do a TEDx event, anyone can do a TEDx event. You basically have to apply for a license from TED. You have to host, if you apply for a standard license anyway, you have to host it in the town where you live. So I applied, it's an application. It's a fairly straightforward application, but they are quite specific and it's quite common to get rejected, but they'll always give you feedback and then you can reapply. So I got rejected twice in my first one because you have to come up with example ideas, and it's quite hard to come up with an idea that are completely different in different sectors, but it really taught me a lot about what makes a good TED idea rather than just a good talk, which was all around, you know, exploring an idea from that open-minded point of view, like almost starting with a question. You can say the theme of the event, but you don't have to. They're like, you don't have to choose a theme in the application, or you can give us what you think your theme might be, but it can change. But you have to actually propose at least three ideas for three talks. You don't have to then do those ideas, but the way you have to say, like, what the idea would be, who you'd approach, or like where you'd approach, and there's one other thing, I can't remember what the other one is. But that's quite tricky because they've all got, I can't talk about three things I know because they're all going to be very similar. And when you look into it, you're like, yeah, it can't be, for example, oh, I think we should all have a device that we can have in our hand. It's like having a telephone that's mobile. It's got to be new and cutting edge. So coming up with three cutting edge. So it's almost like you've got to go out and do research. And this is the approach you take is going either, what's the problem in the world? Like, you know, there's issues of, there's conflict in X area. Okay, but is this for the, so you'd kind of do research maybe in that area. What's a problem and what's a potential solution that might be presenting itself, but you don't fully understand because you're going to find a speaker to fulfill that problem. So yeah, it's kind of, you've got to ask the question, but you've got to be able to find enough. Okay, and this is where I might find the answer to that question. It's quite vague, and it's the hardest bit every year to have to, because I have to keep reapplying. But it's, what's a problem that you think needs solving? And then talking about where you might go with that solution. That's probably a simpler articulation that I finally got to at the end there. And that's what you do. But then you also have to say things like, who will your audience be? And in the first year, I said, oh, I think I'll host it in this area. We do it at the Quarter House, which is a local venue. We have lots of creatives in Folkestone. There's lots of regeneration, blah, blah, blah. I was talking about this, thinking that's a great audience, very specific. And they were like, you can't use it to regenerate, like to help support a regeneration. And my audience was too niche. Like I was talking about, it would be for creatives and it has to be for everyone. So there's little things like that. But part of that you learn through the process of, you know, they'll often come back to you and say, okay, we're not quite sure about this. Can you articulate it a bit more? Or, you know, you're not allowed to do that. Therefore, would you like to do it again, rewrite it? Or could you come up back with something different?
It's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like a simple, on paper, it's simple. But I guess it's
like a tough exam, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like coursework.
They don't ask you specifically the questions. You've got to like understand the values of TED. So it's like read all the stuff, because when I read a bit more about, you know, they're looking for ideas, not speakers, that's when it started to click. And they're saying, you know, what's an idea that's not commonly held, that's maybe a bit like controversial or different. Those are the sort of things you're looking for. So, yeah, I mean, it's almost like a tone, a way of approaching things. Mm-hmm. You've got to come at it. But I learned that through the process.
They check as well if you have any kind of a background in the area or mm-hmm. experience or kind of skills and talks that you've done in the past.
So yes, they do. You have to put in details of like about you, why you're doing it, links to your personal stuff. But I don't think, as far as I understand, and I don't know for sure, I don't think they're looking for someone to have loads of experience in public speaking or organizing events, for example. Like I'd done bits and bobs, but whatever they would look at the internet wouldn't say, oh, she'd be a good organizer. It just mm-hmm. said she does all these random things. So I think what they're looking for more in that point of view is that you're not going to use it commercially, because that's the big thing is like, if you start an event just to promote, you know, to try and get people to sign up to your public speaking course, for example, yeah. then they might come back and say, you're not doing this for the community, you're doing it for yourself. Yeah, as far as I understand, you don't have to have experience or be a pro at it. You just have to be an authentic person that wants to help the community and provide this opportunity to share ideas.
Cool, thank you very much. I have a question that has been appearing in about the past few weeks or so, and mm-hmm. The meaning of authenticity.
Means me. Yeah.
That's a tough word to say, actually.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Okay, so what I think the meaning of authenticity.
What does it mean to you? Yeah, authenticity.
What does it mean to me? It means when what I think and feel is the same, is aligned with what I do and what I say. I don't think
that's
authenticity.
Powerful.
Yeah.
Very, very powerful.
I think it's not about being honest and truthful, because honest and truthful to who? And like my truth will be different from your truth, right? And your viewpoint on something will be different from mine, but they're both true and honest to us. Mm-hmm. But from in terms of the law or whatever it might be, there is a clear right and wrong, but it's right for me. And it's that authenticity is freedom of self-expression, of just what's coming out my mouth, I can trust is true and for me and is what I mean to say. And if people don't agree with it, that's fine. And I don't expect them to, but I'm saying what's right for me. And I will deal with the consequences of people who disagree with that, because I can. Whereas I think the difference is when you're not being authentic, you can feel it inside because you're saying something which doesn't align with your values. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when someone says something negative or, you know, gives you the counter argument, you're more likely to be defensive because you don't, you know.
You feel attacked, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
They
found you at your weak spot, which is mm-hmm. you don't really believe this, but you're kind of trying to blag it. Whereas if someone says, I don't agree with you, I'll go, that's absolutely fine. It's what I believe. And that's all good. And we can agree to disagree. Whereas I'll get defensive if I know that they've smelled a rat. They've smelled that I'm kidding myself. That's always the worst, isn't it?
Yep.
And we kid ourselves.
Cool, thank you very much.
That's all right.
Before we leave, I just want to ask if you have any questions for me.
What's your long-term, like, okay, no, I'm going to change that. Not goal, because we said that's rubbish. If you could get one thing for yourself out of this podcast and the process as a whole, what would that be by the end?
Oof, that's it. That's
you can go away.
That's a great question, actually. I personally think for me, it would be really, really cool if I could actually do like a live podcast on stage.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, like I'm into speaking and kind of I'm a part of Toastmasters, and I just think it will be a cool moment to do kind of a live podcast and engage the audience and the other person or two. That's cool. A tangible kind of thing in the future to try and reach.
Yeah, and not too far in the future, I don't reckon.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said, isn't there? You said it yourself there, like being able to gauge the audience and react. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives us the confidence to speak, right? When we know Definitely. That the audience is like loving it, you speak more. It's the power of the listener. I don't think people who listen to like an audience understands the power that they have to influence that speaker just by listening. And I don't know. I don't know why I was going with that comment, but I just think it's amazing. There should be more stuff done around listening.
Really cool. Thank you very much.
No worries.
I think I've learned a lot as well. So thank you very much.
I hope you enjoy that interview. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts so I can grow and improve. And thank you again.